Hello and welcome. My name is Tom Degnan. I'm here for Irish America Magazine, and we are pleased to have a very timely guest with us today, Fordham University's John Feerick. He has had a very long and impressive career in government and academia, and also happens to have one of the best or worst coincidences happen, great timing or bad timing, depending on your definition. He's one of the foremost experts we have on the 25th Amendment, which is very much in the news today. He also has a new memoir out called That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots. Irish America Magazine is pleased to welcome John Feerick. Professor Feerick, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here today.
So let's get the business that everybody's talking about out of the way. Imagine for a moment there's a person out there who doesn't have a strong opinion one way or the other about the president or impeachment or all those related topics. You have written an authoritative book on the 25th Amendment. It was used in the writing of the actual 25th Amendment. For people who just sort of want to know a little bit about the 25th Amendment, give us sort of a thumbnail sketch. When was it passed? Why was it passed? What should your average American citizen know about the 25th Amendment?
I would say three points about the 25th Amendment. Before going into the 3 points, it was adopted and became part of the Constitution in February 1967. And its development began about 1955. And over a 10-year period, how to deal with a disability of a president of the United States became an issue that they Congress wanted to deal with, because Eisenhower had suffered at different points in that mid-1950 time period, three disabilities, had a stroke, had a heart attack, and it became clear that the problem of presidential inability, which had existed during the Wilson administration, during the period that President James Garfield was assassinated, and it was 80 days before he died, and finally, after President Kennedy's assassination, a movement started to really address it and put an amendment in the Constitution, because when he died, it was a possibility he might not have died, and he would have been disabled, and there would be questions about presidential inability. And what the 25th Amendment does is, in point one, it says that in a case of inability, a successor to presidential power is an acting president, not an actual president. And the acting president, of course, is the vice president. There was a question about that. In a case of inability, what is the status of a vice president? And the 25th Amendment makes clear that a vice president is an acting president, doesn't become president. President is not removed from his office. He's only suspended, you might say, in a case of inability, from his powers and duties. So Section 1 of the 25th Amendment says that, unlike inability, in a case of death, resignation, and removal on conviction, the vice president becomes president for the rest of the term. And that's changing the original succession provision of the Constitution. The second point is, what if you don't have a vice president? Suppose a vice president dies or resigns or is removed. Where do you go on that? 25th Amendment, for the first time in our history, sets up a procedure for filling a vacancy in the vice presidency. And a vacancy procedure involves a nomination by the president and confirmation by both houses of Congress of that person who's been nominated by the president. The president has the power to nominate, because there's an expectation that the vice president and the president will work together. And the third part of the amendment has to do with where I started, a presidential inability. Although that's what gave the momentum to having a constitutional amendment, that's placed in two sections of the amendment. First section says, the president is going to undergo I've given this as an example, a surgery, and he's going to be unconscious. He can, in advance of the surgery, say to the vice president, I'm transferring my powers and duties to you for the duration of the surgery. And as soon as the surgery is over and I feel I'm ready to come back, I'll let you know. And he goes back. When I say go back to discharging his powers and duties. He never loses the title and the office of president. The second point, which there's been a lot of discussion about in the past week, is, well, what happens if the president is unable to make a decision of inability, but he appears to be disabled? How do we deal with that? And what the amendment says is that it doesn't define inability, but it sets up a process. And it says, well, the cabinet and the vice president, people who are loyal to the president and people he was involved in their appointments, they have the power to say the president is disabled, in which case the vice president becomes acting president, as he would in the case of a voluntary declaration of inability. But it has more to it than that. There might be a situation where the vice president and the cabinet disagree with the president. President says, I don't agree with that, I'm disabled. And their determination will result in the vice president immediately becoming the acting president, but then Congress is going to have to take care and resolve the issue of who's right, who's wrong, and Congress has 21 days to do so.
And just one
other point, and if both houses of Congress by two-thirds vote say that the president is disabled, he doesn't resume his powers and duties, or to put it another way, if the president is able to secure a vote of one-third plus one of either house of Congress, he immediately resumes his powers and duties.
And just to be clear, a lot of people have been talking about the 25th Amendment lately, but impeachment has also happened, and people might get the two of those things jumbled up, but essentially those are two completely different processes, correct?
That's correct. And impeachment would be a process dealing with issues of fitness, for office. You see in the Constitution, treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. And what's a high crime and misdemeanor? That expression in the United States Constitution has a long history in the English common law, where there were parliamentary impeachment proceedings. And it's using power in a corrupt and evil way, an abusive way, could give rise to a high crime and misdemeanor. And the Constitution says, we're not going to define it, just like inability. And we're going to say that the House of Representatives has the sole power of deciding if impeachment exists. And if they do conclude, as happened yesterday, that there is an impeachment of a public official, yesterday was, of course, the President of the United States, then the Senate is going to have to hear what the House has to say in the form of a trial. And the House, and in the case of a president, the Chief Justice of the United States would serve as the presiding officer of a trial of a president, not of an ex-president. The Constitution doesn't speak of an ex-president, it just says of a president. So the Chief Justice would serve as the presiding judge. The senators would all be both jury and the judges, so to speak, because what they have to say will result in either the president being convicted or not, and it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate to decide on whether or not there's a grounds that what the House said was impeachable constitutes grounds for removal from office. And if they conclude by two-thirds vote that the president is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, he's immediately loses his office as President of the United States. You never lose your office in a disability situation. And the House also the Senate also can take up the question of whether or not the president should be prevented from holding future office. And that vote does not require 2/3. That's a majority of the Senate. And we've had several presidential impeachments. In each case, there was an acquittal. It happened when Andrew Johnson was president. It happened when William Clinton was president. And it happened earlier in this presidency, the case of President Trump. And in all of those cases, the case was not did not satisfy the 2/3 vote requirement. And so there was an acquittal. And you never got to the issue of a disqualification from a future office. Constitution also says, notwithstanding an impeachment of a public official, the public official is still open to other kinds of punishment by law, indictment and conviction of a crime. That still hangs there, because an impeachment proceeding is dealing with high crimes and misdemeanors. And that expression really, as one studies the common law precedents, and I've looked at that those precedents in a major article I did on the subject of impeachment many years ago, and it's how you use power, but then that it can be subject to debate.
In terms of your area expertise, the 25th Amendment, Mike Pence has not shown that he's interested in doing this, correct?
Correct. That's he made that clear in a letter, I believe, that he sent to the Speaker of the House of Representatives. That's my understanding.
If he had said, yeah, I think I want to pursue this, it would have essentially ended the impeachment process, correct? And then the cabinet and the vice president would have gone off and done what they had to do?
I'm not so sure one can answer that with certainty, because if the Vice President Pence and a majority of the cabinet, and that's what's, as you know, required by the 25th Amendment, had made that decision, the Vice President would have immediately became acting president. He would have all the powers and duties of the presidency, however, the president would still have large, would have been caught up in an impeachment process, possibly. In other words, what the House might have made a decision not to go forward with the House proceedings, which are designed to deal with accountability, and you might say, with respect to allegations made about the president's conduct. The disability is not dealing with that at all. It's just saying the president disabled, and we want the vice president to be acting as the president with all the powers and duties of the presidency. It's sort of a different process altogether. So One could conjure up a hypothetical where they both go forward. On the other hand, one could conclude that the speaker would not move ahead with impeachment in circumstances where there was a serious issue of the president's physical or mental capacity.
It's pretty amazing that we can be sitting here talking about this, and it's a scenario that you spent much of your life investigating. And it's so unprecedented that we're not necessarily sure what could or might happen next.
Right. We've been fortunate throughout the history of our country, and obviously luck sometimes runs out, but there've been a lot of close calls. We've been able to successfully move through those and take what we just talking about. the vice president didn't invoke, didn't agree to invoke, and he's critical. You need the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. You could have a majority, the vice president doesn't agree, the 25th is not invoked. So, and there was a few famous Americans. One that I greatly admired was Eisenhower's Attorney General, Herbert Brownell. And he used to say that that you can't regulate everything. You can't deal with every possibility. And at the end of the day, there might be situations where all you can count on is the good faith of public officials or public servants stepping up and doing what they had to do to resolve a potential crisis. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in those remarks. And we didn't have the problem we were talking about of two proceedings clashing or moving in different directions.
A final technical question. This is already a very complex situation. Was it made further or more complicated because it happened after the November election, or did that not necessarily jumble this already messy situation?
Well, I guess everything has been made more difficult and complicated by what transpired after the election. The people went to vote on November 3rd for presidential electors. The presidential electors met 41 days later in December, and they cast all over the United States electoral votes that gave someone a majority, which is required by the Constitution, but it was for the Congress when it met in December to determine whether that majority certify, in a sense, what was done by the Electoral College, and there was a challenge on the votes throughout the period that was dealt with in court case after court case throughout the United States in the period between November 3rd and December 16th when the electors met. And so by the time December 16th had come around, I think it was close to 60 court decisions that having to do with the right to vote and the accuracy of the vote. And those decisions became were challenged in a sense by the president and those who supported the president in the period after December 16th, before and after, and that was something. After it was something highly unusual, to say the least. So that was a circumstance of. That was unprecedented in the history of our country, as I see it. And normally what would transpire is a peaceful transition, even though there might be unhappiness about who won the election. And we didn't see that at this time.
I want to ask a couple more questions about this process before we move on to your Irish-American memoir.
Thank you.
Let me reintroduce you. My name is Tom Degnan. I'm here for Irish American Magazine, talking to John Feerick, expert on the 25th Amendment, which many people are talking about these days. This stuff is changing by the hour, so we're giving you the most updated information we can. Without necessarily asking you, Professor Feerick, feel free to share whatever necessarily personal aspects you have about the personalities and politicians involved, but what is it like for you to sort of see these questions raised at this time? Does it make you angry? Is it surreal? This is something you've looked into for a very long time. What is it like to sort of see all this stuff unfold in real time?
Well, I start with a great deal of sadness because of the unrest that has been created. Number two, I'm disappointed in what I would have expected the constitutional process would have been after the electors had cast their votes. To see the continued challenge on on the validity of the election at that point, against the background of an independent and impartial judiciary in all over the country, in scores of cases, and making clear that there was not fraud to vitiate the electoral votes. And I'm somebody that feels very strongly about the importance of the judiciary and the rule of law. And I was, to say the least, very disappointed by the attacks on the rule of law based on the almost uniform results in court cases with respect to the right to vote.
In the end, do you think Vice President Mike Pence could have or should have invoked the 25th Amendment?
What I thought was, and I've said this also in another forum, a judgment call. Was there a disability opposed to conduct that might be impeachable? Was there a disability that warranted him and a cabinet invoking the 25th Amendment? And they not doing so is a judgment I respect because they're best able to decide in that process whether or not the circumstances compel that. And I can't get my hands around what might have gone on in that room. Had they exercised it, that, in my judgment, would have been appropriate, based on what I see. Had they not done what they and they had not done what I can't criticize that because that's a personal judgment on their part, and I know that a lot of people have felt maybe they should have invoked it, but on the other hand, would that have resolved the issue? The issue is played itself out in a way that a bipartisan House of Representatives, in terms of the vote, felt it was conduct that was impeachable, and that's different from unable and disability.
Let me ask kind of a segue question here. The first part of my question would be, how did you actually end up getting interested in this question of presidential succession? Which I'd also, could you add to that? How did you end up getting interested in all this government and political business in the first place? In terms of moving into a discussion of your memoir, That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots. Can you tell me a little bit about why you got interested in this topic and those related topics, and if your Irish background had any role in that?
Well, my Irish background was 100% because in terms of a role, my parents didn't get beyond the primary grades, and they grew up on farms, family farms in Ireland. They were very poor, and they came here. And the one thing that they said to I was the oldest, firstborn, said to me and my siblings, I had four siblings. My brother Donald died 20 years ago now. Get an education, and make something of yourself. And I got an education at Fordham University. And I was introduced to the Constitution of the United States in first year of Fordham College. And it became very interested in the Constitution. And so that by the time I got to law school, which started when I was in college, President Eisenhower was serving as President of the United States, and that the question of disability was out there. I hadn't thought about it in the context of writing about it at the time, but by the time I got into the last part of law school, I saw articles that of debate about disability of a president, and I decided as I was leaving law school that was an interesting issue to write about, because the problem of presidents' ability was left unresolved by the framers of the Constitution, and there was a practical application of it in terms of the Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower was frustrated that the Congress had not been able to address it. Too many different ideas around in the Congress. So I decided to write on it. I wrote an article in the Fordham Law Review. And in October of 1963, it was published by the Fordham Law Review. I sent reprints of the article around, hoping that some people would have an interest in the subject. I sent it to President Kennedy. I sent it to Robert Kennedy. I sent it to Ted Kennedy. I sent it to Henry Wallace, who's Roosevelt's vice president. And I sent it to Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, among others, because they all had some interest in the problem. And Arthur Kroc took my article. Little did I realize 3 weeks later, President Kennedy would be assassinated. And when he was assassinated, the issue was, what would have happened had he lived? And how would we have dealt with disability of a president? And Arthur Kroc, in his New York Times article that weekend, said there was a good study of the subject in the Fordham Law Review. And that was because I had sent him a reprint of the article. Otherwise, he wouldn't have known about it. And that changed my life. And because I was asked to join 12 senior lawyers, so to speak, who were brought together by the American Bar Association, including Eisenhower's Attorney General, including a future Supreme Court Justice of the United States, a very distinguished group, not myself, but the other 11 people. And at the same time, in a parallel but unconnected way, Senator Birch Bayh, a United States Senator from Indiana, in his first year in office, inherited the chairmanship of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he wanted the ABA's support, and the ABA wanted him to come over and become part of the discussions they were having. And I sat next to him. And at the end of that day, his proposal was very, very much supported by the American Bar Association. And they made some suggestions, which he subsequently incorporated in the proposal. And that was January of 1964. By the fall of 1964, the United States Senate adopted that proposed constitutional amendment. And then it was introduced in January of 1965 in both houses of Congress. And it changed, and detail was put into it, and it went out to the states for ratification and went into the Constitution in 1967. Throughout that process, I worked with Senator Bayh, his staff, also with leaders in Congress, in the House of Representatives, both political parties, and they asked my views on different things. They asked me to look at language. They asked me to comment. And as I was doing that, the American Bar Association asked me to chair a committee of young lawyers in every state of the country who got very active in every state of the country, educating about the ABA proposal and the Birch Bayh proposal. And Emanuel Selle was at the House of Representatives. He supported that as well. And he was a great leader in addition to Senator Bayh. And that got the bar, the lawyers in every state in the country was supporting the amendment. And I also wrote some articles at the time to educate about what the proposal was. I spoke to League of Women Voters organizations and other groups. Little did I realize that because I was a young associate in a then small law firm, and I was working this into, I had to work it into my time because I also was expected to bill clients a certain amount of hours. I don't think I realized I was living through a historic moment and a historic development. And at the end of it all, we had a constitutional amendment, and I was invited by the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, to come to the ceremony for proclaiming the amendment. And I couldn't help but think that thanks to young lawyers, and especially Senator Birch Bayh and the Young Lawyers of America, and we put something in the Constitution that was needed, and there was a safety net to deal with unforeseen circumstances. And as I look back now, that's a long time ago. I'm 84 years of age. It stands out as the single most important experience of my professional life.
Can you talk a little bit more about how having, you mentioned that essentially your parents' lack of education was a motivation for you to obtain an education. Can you talk more, a little bit more about how having both your parents from Mayo, correct?
Correct, up Mayo, yes.
How did that shape you? How did that influence you, having parents like that?
Well, as I said, to get an education and make something of myself. Two, they always had a sense of the importance of participation in by voting and giving to others. You might say they in different ways. My father went away during the war years, and building bases in Greenland and Newfoundland and the Aleutian Islands, and military installations. We didn't see my father for a good 4 years or so. And my mother was at home raising three before the war. I was exposed to education, and in Fordham College exposed me to government. I was vice president of my class in third year, vice president of student government at Fordham in my last year. So I had a love for government, but it's all traceable to my home life. Even though my father was away for 5 years during the war years, there was a family unit there, how do I model my behavior for my parents?
And Fordham itself is essentially the product built literally by Irish immigrants as well. And so that's obviously a big chunk of your youth there. And your parents settled in the Bronx, correct?
Yeah, they settled in the Bronx, and most of my youth was near a block from the Melrose train stop on 161st Street, between Morris and Park Avenues, and take me 10 minutes to go from there to Yankee Stadium. And I used to play a lot of basketball and other sports over in that area. I went to school right around the corner, a Catholic school. I didn't have to pay any tuition. And St. Ignatius Merici, where Babe Ruth used to go to Mass. I didn't know that, but I learned that much later in life. And I was educated by the Ursuline Sisters. I went to a high school, Bishop Bois, once again, $5 a month tuition, because my father couldn't afford $10 a month. And thanks to my Catholic education that was available to me, I've remained very much involved in the life of my church, very supportive of the inner city scholarship. I was one of the co-chairs of that program for a dozen years with two other great lawyers who are now deceased, Jim Gill and Paul Curran. So I tell the story of my parents and I spent about 10 of the 18 years that took me to write the book. I spent going to Ireland, trying to learn more about their family, what it must have been like, what it was like for them before they left America. That's all in the book.
You actually start the book off, and again, as we sort of close things out here, just to remind people one more time, we're talking to John Feerick of Fordham University, expert on the 25th Amendment, which many people are talking about these days. He also has a new memoir out, That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots. And you actually start the book with two literary quotes. As a teacher, I've taught both of these works. The one I don't need to discuss necessarily is Shakespeare's What's in a Name. I would like to hear why you felt, because you don't really expound on this, you just kind of put the quote out there. Why did you want to put the famous last line of Great Gatsby? You start the book off that way. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Why is that an important quote to you?
Well, because it takes me back to the past. And my past is tied to my parents' past. That I had a vacuum I realized I had when my parents died. My father died in 1988. My mother died in the following year. And my father had colon cancer, so over 3 years he dealt with that challenge. My mother had dementia, and for 10 years we did all we could to help my mother, and all of a sudden they're gone, and I can cry almost any moment because I miss them so much. In my judgment, you never leave your parents. They're always there, even though they're not there physically. So they were, by modern terms, nobodies, right? They were loyal citizens, and I've had a lot of blessings and opportunities, which I talk about in the book. I was president of the bar in New York City. I was dean of a law school for 20 years. In terms of deans of New York law schools, after the post-World War II, I served longer than anyone else in the position of deanship of a law school. So I took note of the fact that I had so many wonderful opportunities and blessings, but it's all because of my parents. So bring them alive, because I'm their creation with God's assistance.
And so we beat on. Final question, the full name of your book again, John Feerick, That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots and American promise. That subtitle, just as a sort of maybe closing question, I don't need to tell you, wherever people come down on certain political questions, the emotions around immigration right now are really raw, really on both sides. People get really people get really worked up about this thing that has always been with us as a nation. As the child of immigrants himself, what is it like for you to go through this time where people are having such heated discussions about immigration? And what do you think is sort of missing from that discussion? What do you think you'd like to hear a little bit more of when it comes to immigration as the child of immigrants?
Right. Well, first of all, let me just say, I'm not registered as a Democrat or Republican. My life has been somebody who's an independent, and part of the reason I'm an independent because I've had so many opportunities in constitutional reform, not only the 25th Amendment, but I was asked to be counseled to a major commission that looked to deal with the Electoral College system. I worked for 12 years on that. So I found, without my realizing where I was going with my life, that reform was, and constitutional reform, legal reform, was at the center of my life. And if you were to take a look at my almost 60 years as a lawyer, you will see many writings, you'll see many, many acts of participation by me on bars, chairing committees of the bar, appointed by judges, appointed by mayors, and law reform came central to my life. And I try to talk about that in the context of all the people that I worked with. because I was nobody by myself, but I could have fulfillment by working in collaborations and with others, and I've done that in all of my activities. In terms of immigration at the present time, America is a creation. The United States of America is a creation of immigrants, and we had natives here, very important, obviously, to the land that we occupy. But for the last two plus centuries, immigrants to America, sometimes not well received, like the Irish in the 19th century, they weren't well received, and we should be on the forefront of supporting appropriate immigration to the United States, not closing the doors at all, but putting I would say pressure on those in the political processes to come with some major reform of our that has a lot of balances in there, and I don't think it's right to just leave that world of immigration so cloudy as it is right now. I'm not saying you open the doors to immigration, but what I am saying is give people the opportunity. People like my parents had came here not as citizens, but they became naturalized citizens. They didn't present any threat coming here, and they paid their taxes. They were loyal. They were participatory citizens. And so many people out there who are yearning to come to America would fit the mold of my parents. And so I'm very supportive of reform, and very disappointed that our Congress has not been able to come and develop a consensus, just like the Congress of both political parties did in terms of the 25th Amendment of the Constitution. They should be able to do that in the area of immigration. And I hope we're going to see that in the coming years.
One more famous quote is, "May you live in interesting times." And John Vierick, you certainly have. And through a great bit of timing, it turns out your area of expertise is very handy right now. And it's changing every day. We're going to both keep our eyes on it. My name is Tom Degnan. We've been talking to Professor John Vierick of Fordham University, expert on the 25th Amendment, and the author of That Further Shore, A Memoir of Irish Roots and American Promise. One more point you want to make, Professor Vierick?
I didn't. Just to wrap up the last point, almost 15 years ago, I founded at Fordham Law School a Center for Social Justice at the suggestion of the then dean of Fordham Law School. And a central part of our work has to do with immigration and undocumented children who are here, but they've been put in like a whole category for a long time. Those who are seeking access to at the Mexico or Texas border based on political asylum status. My Social Justice Center has been very much involved in all that. So I'm very much, and we've been recognized by the highest award of the American College and not for that activity dealing with immigration. The American College of Trial Lawyers, one of the most distinguished groups in the United States, and also by the Jesuit Refugee Corps, saluted our center for all the immigration work we're doing. I didn't want my words about immigration to not include the activity that we are currently doing in that area.
Yeah, that would certainly fit the American Promise part of your memoir subtitle.
Thank you.
All right, Professor Vierick, thank you so much for your time. Have a good night.
You and thank you very much. Take care now.